Good. Well, I think perhaps we'd better set off. We're only 5 minutes late, which is remarkable by my standards. This is a stickered lecture, I was asked to tell you. I think you probably knew already. It's my enormous pleasure to introduce this evening Professor Andreas Kappala, who is the Professor of Eastern European History at the University of Köln. He's going to talk on hierarchies of ethnic groups in the Russian Empire. Professor Kappala is certainly the leading expert on the minorities of the Russian Empire in contemporary Europe, indeed I would say in the West as a whole. He has written a number of works, the first of which I came across is Ruslan's Erste Nationalitäten, on the Volga Tatars. And the book which is probably best known to a wider audience, Russland aus Vielvölkerei, a big survey of problems of empire in pre-revolutionary Russia, which ought to have been translated and published in English by Longmans already 2 or 3 years ago, and we all hope very much will finally emerge very quickly. It's my great pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming. By the way, Professor Kappala kindly said that he would answer questions after the talk.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, thank you very much for introducing me, for the kind words, and thank you for inviting me and for giving me the possibility to give a lecture at this famous school. Firstly, I have to apologize for my poor English. And to reassure myself, I'm starting my lecture in Russian. Божьей милостью мы, Екатерина II, императрица и самодержца Всероссийская, Московская, Киевская, Владимирская, Новгородская, царица Казанская, царица Астраханская, царица Сибирская, царица Херсониса Таврического, Государыня Псковская и Великая Княгиня Смоленская, Княгиня Эстлянская, Лифлянская и так далее. This is the beginning of the title of Catherine II, here from her Charter to the Nobility of 1785, which enumerates the territories belonging to the Tsarist Empire. Their order reflects the historical formation of the empire and the relative prestige of its regions. It could serve as a base for the reconstruction of a hierarchy of the territories of the Russian Empire, but not of its ethnic groups. The following paragraph of this source refers to the huge expanse of the empire from Kamchatka to Riga, from the Caspian Sea to the Arctic Ocean. Then Catherine turns to her subjects, the inhabitants of the empire, to the obedient, brave, fearless, enterprising, and strong people of Russia who are guided by their belief in God and their faithfulness to the throne. И сим образом в истинной славе и величестве империи вкушаем плоды и познаем следствия действия нам подвластного, послушного, храброго, неустрашимого, предприимчивого и сильного российского народа, когда верою к Богу, верностью к престолу он управляет. In the following passage, the charter turns to the nobles, who for 800 years had served Russia as leaders and who, with the help of God, would excel forever in its qualities for leadership. Начальников и предводителей таковых Россия через течение 800 лет от времени своего основания находила сред своих сынов. Наипаче же во всякое время свойственной было, есть до помощи Божией и прибудет вечно российскому дворянству отличаться качествами, блистающими к начальству. This extract of the Charter to the Nobility gives us not only an insight into the imperial language and thinking, but it also instructs us about some of the basic characteristics of the traditional Russian Empire. Firstly, Imperia, empire, is used by Catherine as a positive term, as was common until the revolution. I shall use it here exactly in this sense, without any negative connotations that the term imperia has in the Russia of today. Secondly, Catherine always uses the term rasiski, which refers to the empire, the state, and never uses the ethnic notion ruski, Russian. For instance, Rasiskaya or Vsirasiskaya Imperia Rasiski Narod. Our problem lies in the difficulties of translating this term, which is also the official name of the present Russian state, Rasiskaya Federatsiya. In Germany, we are now trying to introduce the term Russländisch for Rasiski in opposition to the ethnic term Russisch for Ruski. I have no clear idea how to make this distinction in English. Maybe one could designate the empire as all Russian, see Rasiskaya, or as Valery Tishkov has proposed with the neologism Russian. In any case, it is important to keep in mind that in our context, the English word Russian means the polyethnic state as well as the ethnic group. Thirdly, Catherine stresses two of the main pillars of the empire, namely the loyalty of her subjects to the throne, to the dynasty, Viernost Priestolu, and the crucial position of the nobility, Rasiskaya Dvoryanstvo. In her charter to the nobility, she does not mention, however, the various peoples or ethnic groups of the empire, among them the Russian people, Ruski Narod. This reflects the priorities of pre-modern European empires, where ethnic factors like language and culture and even religion usually played a subordinate role. The decisive elements of legitimation and organizations were the ruler and the dynasty and the social system of legal groups, Saslovia, estates, with the nobility at the top. If ethnic categories did not play a significant role, why am I asking about hierarchies of ethnic groups in the old Russian Empire? The question indeed is somewhat anachronistic. It starts from the national age and looks for an explanation of the national problem which began to undermine the Tsarist Empire in the course of the 19th century. On the other hand, it is evident that the more than 100 ethnic groups counted in the census of 1897 were not regarded by the imperial center as of equal status, but were arranged in a hierarchic order. Such hierarchies have never been explicitly formulated. They only can be deduced from the Tsarist policy towards the various ethnic groups of the empire. My assumption is that this model of hierarchies of ethnic groups can help us in explaining the character of the traditional multi-ethnic empire, especially the government policy towards the various ethnic groups and its changes in the 19th and 20th centuries. I have identified three hierarchies, two of them corresponding to the two bases of legitimacy mentioned earlier. One hierarchy of the ethnic groups is based on the criterion of political loyalty. A second on the criterion of estate. The third one relates to cultural criteria such as way of life, religion, or language. These three hierarchies interacted. They were not static. The classification of the individual ethnic group and the relative importance of the hierarchies were changing over the centuries. Firstly, the hierarchy of political loyalty. The loyalty of all subjects to the throne, to the dynasty, and to the ruler was a linchpin of the Tsarist Empire. The center's first priority was to secure power and social-political stability. The loyalty of the non-Russians in the peripheral regions was therefore of prime importance. From the viewpoint of the Tsarist government, the ethnic groups of the empire were arranged in an unofficial hierarchy according to the degree of their actual or suspected loyalty or disloyalty. The ethnic Russians normally were at the top of the hierarchy. Their loyalty was in some way a matter of course. Nevertheless, rulers like Ivan the Terrible or Nicholas I sometimes felt non-Russians to be more reliable than Russians, and therefore trusted Tatars or Germans more and used them as instruments against the Russian nobility. Nomads and semi-nomads, such as the Kalmyks, Bashkirs, or Kazakhs, were regarded as unreliable subjects, as potential or actual traitors. This opinion derived from the long experience of difficult interrelations, replete of misunderstandings and militant resistance, which the Russian side interpreted as treason. Before the 19th century, the Cossacks occupied a similar place at the bottom of the hierarchy of political loyalty. This was especially so for the Ukrainian Cossacks, whose leader, Hetman Ivan Mazepa, was anathematized as the arch traitor. Later, the Caucasian mountaineers, especially the Chechens, also were regarded as traitors, and in Russian nursery rhymes, they were used as bogeymen. Sometimes this suspicion was related to foreign policy, as is true for the Crimean Tatars, especially during the Crimean War and the Russo-Turkish War. In the 1860s and 70s, the Tsarist government furthered and sometimes forced mass immigration of people suspected of disloyalty, namely the Crimean Tatars, Circassians, Abkhazians, Chechens, and other Caucasian groups. This group, suspected of disloyalty, was joined by the Poles, especially after the two uprisings of 1830 and 1863. In this time, the Poles were moving into the center of Tsarist politics. In the second half of the 19th century, many of the opposition movements and other political problems in Russia were explained simply by Polish intrigues. This suspicion was nurtured by the political activities of the Poles in Austria and Germany. Polish intrigues, in the view of the Tsarist government, were the main cause for the national movement of other ethnic groups in the western part of the empire, namely the Ukrainians and Lithuanians. The Jews were placed into this context too. With the growth of anti-Semitism in Russia and the propagation of the myth of the revolutionary Jew and of a universal Jewish conspiracy, the Jews in Russia gained the reputation of unreliable subjects and potential spies. On the other hand, the German Balts, the Finlanders, Swedish and Finnish, the German colonists and the Armenians were regarded as faithful servants of the Tsar. They received special privileges, and the two first groups were strongly overrepresented in the army and bureaucracy of the empire. In the first half of the 19th century, in the eyes of the monarch, they deserved more trust than Russian elites, as I mentioned earlier. In the last quarter of the 19th century, however, the German Balts, the German colonists, the Armenians and the Finlanders, and one after another, lost their reputation as reliable subjects and slid down the pyramid of loyalty. In a heightened fear of disloyal groups during the First World War, hundreds of thousands of Poles, Jews and Germans were deported from the region bordering on Austria and Germany. The growth of antagonism was connected with problems of Russian foreign policy again, with the rise of nationalism and the concomitant cultural hierarchization of the ethnic groups. I shall come back to this problem later. The perceptions of ethnic groups as loyal or as treacherous represented not only ethnopsychological prejudices, but they were weighty political factors. As the legitimacy and stability of the Tsarist Empire was based on the loyalty of its subjects, and especially its elites, real or suspect disloyalty was of crucial importance for the government and its policy. These patterns survived the Russian Revolution and emerged again under Stalin. Secondly, the hierarchy of estates. The central principle guaranteeing the coherence of the Russian polyethnic empire from the 16th century was cooptation of non-Russian elites into the imperial upper stratum. This corresponded to the estate structure of the Tsarist state and its decisive political element, the alliance of the ruler with the nobility. The model was the Russian nobility as it had emerged in the Muscovite Empire and consolidated its position in the 18th century, finally through the Charter of 1785 mentioned before. For the hierarchic organization of the constantly growing number of non-Russian ethnic groups, it was therefore critically important whether they possessed their own elites, whether these elites were loyal to the Tsar, and whether they conformed to the model of the Russian nobility. If they owned landed property with dependent peasants and had a written culture recognized as autonomous, they were accepted as equals of the Russian nobles. Together with the Russians, these ethnic groups were at the top of the estate hierarchy. This high esteem concerned only the members of the elite and not of the other social groups. So the Russian nobility naturally was at the top of this hierarchy. On the other hand, the social and legal position of Russian peasants was not automatically better than that of non-Russian peasants, but sometimes worse. Already in the 16th century, those of the loyal Muslim Volga-Tatar elite who had not fled or been killed were co-opted into the imperial nobility and even provided with Christian Russian peasants. However, they lost this privileged position in the first half of the 18th century. After the Tatars, in the 17th century, the Polonized Shlachta of Smolensk was co-opted. In the 18th century, the German, Baltic, and Polish nobility, and in the 19th century, the Finnish, Swedish, Romanian, Bessarabian, and Georgian nobility, as well as, with some restrictions, the Muslim aristocracy of the Crimea, of Transcaucasia, and of several ethnic groups of the North Caucasus. In the last third of the 19th century, however, the Muslim aristocrats of Central Asia were no longer being co-opted into the nobility of the empire. This was related again to the changing pattern of cultural hierarchy. The non-Russian elites received the guarantee of their privileges, their faith, and their estates with dependent peasants, their position over time being matched to that of the Russian nobility. The Russian nobles enjoyed no superior privileges than the co-opted non-Russians had. On the contrary, some of the privileges of the German Baltic, Finlandian, and until 1830 Polish nobility surpassed the rights of the Russian nobles. In return for their privileges, non-Russian nobles were required, like their Russian counterparts, to serve the Tsar in the army and bureaucracy and to guarantee stability in their regions. The fact that co-opted elites included non-Orthodox and even non-Christian groups shows that the autocracy, until the middle of the 19th century, set more store in the estate principle than in orthodoxy and narodnost nationality proclaimed by Uvarov. The principle of cooptation of non-Russian elites resulted in a non-Russian majority among the hereditary nobility of the Tsarist Empire. Traditionally, some of the new subject peoples, like the Poles and Georgians, had a very high percentage of nobles, and also not all of them received or maintained the recognition as nobles. They had a much higher percentage of nobles than Russians had. According to the census of 1897, only 40% of the hereditary nobility consisted of Russians, of ethnic Russians, who represented 44% of the total population. But approximately 30% of Poles, 7% of the total population, and 6% of Georgians, 1% of the total population. These numbers prove how much the estate order preserved traditions. In reality, however, most of Polish and Georgian nobles did not own landed estates and did not constitute a social elite. If the co-opted elites withdrew or appeared to withdraw from loyalty, their loyalty from the Tsar, the government revoked some of their privileges. This happened first of all to the Poles after the two uprisings. Since loyalty to the ruler and dynasty were preconditions of the alliance with the elites, this reaction was a consistent one. The hierarchy of estate and the hierarchy of loyalty were therefore closely interrelated. At the next level of the estate hierarchy were the ethnic groups with elites that did not conform to the model of the Russian nobility. Privileges and certain rights of self-administration were also guaranteed to these elites, also they were not regarded as the equals of Russian nobles, and so, with the exception of individual dignitaries, were not co-opted into the nobility of the empire. This group included primarily ethnic groups in the peripheral regions in the east and south of the empire, mostly nomads like Bashkirs or Kazakhs. The Ukrainians of the Hetmanate, with their Cossack elite, were regarded by Moscow in the 17th century also as part of the steppe and can be placed at this time on this second level of the estate hierarchy. The elites of this type had basically two prospects. Either they could achieve recognition as nobles, or they would be reclassified as state peasants or inorodtsy aliens. While the Ukrainian Cossack aristocracy took the first path and gradually Ukrainian Cossack aristocracy took gradually became the little Russian nobility, the nomadic elites in the 19th century were recognized less and less by the imperial center as equal partners. In this way, the second level disappeared gradually from the hierarchy. As a rule, ethnic groups with no indigenous elites could not become direct partners of the Tsarist government. A partial exception were the mobilized diaspora groups of Jews, Armenians, and Greeks, all of which had an urban middle stratum and an independent ecclesiastical organization. The Tsarist state had long depended on the specific abilities of these groups, which were complementary to the abilities of the military landowning elite. Therefore, it worked together with them, co-opting their elites into the upper urban estates. Rich merchants and religious dignitaries were in part able to assume their role of the noble elites as partners with the imperial center. These diaspora groups, therefore, can be placed on a separate third level of the estate pyramid. On the fourth level were several ethnic groups living in the central and eastern part of the empire. While these possessed no indigenous nobility and were made up mostly of peasants, they were not dependent on foreign landowners. This applies to the small groups of Chuvash, Mordvinians, Mari, Udmurt, Komi, the Yakuts, and other ethnic groups of Siberia, as well as several mountaineers of the Caucasus, such as the Chechens. At the bottom of the estate hierarchy were the ethnic groups that were made up predominantly of peasants, which were dependent on elites of other ethnic origins. Together with the aforementioned groups assigned to the fourth level, these are referred to in comparative research on nationalism as small or young peoples possessing on the eve of the age of nationalism neither an indigenous elite nor a continuous tradition of a state, a standard language, or an advanced culture. This category included in the Tsarist Empire the Finns, Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, Belarusians, and these Ukrainians who had belonged to Poland-Lithuania until the partition. For a long time, the center had not regarded these peasant peoples as distinct ethnic groups and as political subjects, becoming aware of them only in connection with the superordinate nobles. So, the imperial center associated the Estonians and Latvians with the German Balts, and the Lithuanians, Belarusians, and right-bank Ukrainians with the Poles. This close connection was one of the reasons that, together with the persecution of the Poles, the Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Lithuanian written languages perceived as a product of Polish intrigues were forbidden after 1863. The estate hierarchy of ethnic groups was an important structural element of the Tsarist Empire. It also determined the hierarchy of cultures and languages in this time. Only those ethnic groups with their own elites could possess advanced cultures and written languages, in addition to the Russians, namely the Poles, Finlandian Swedes, German Balts, and Tatars, and with some restrictions, the Jews, Armenians, and Georgians. The languages of other ethnic groups, which for a long time did not have standardized written languages, were regarded only as dialects. The principle of cooperation with non-Russian elites remained in force at least until the mid-19th century. With the Polish uprising of 1863, the Tsarist government for the first time began to move away from the principle of cooperation with the co-opted non-Russian nobility. Simultaneously, it tried in the subsequent agrarian reforms to play the Polish, Lithuanian, Belarusian, and Ukrainian peasants off against their Polish masters. Later, some similar efforts were made in regard to the Estonian and Latvian peasants and their German Baltic lords. But all this happened by no means consistently, as Daniel Beauvoir recently has shown for the right bank Ukraine. In the revolution of 1905, when Latvian and Estonian peasants killed many German estate owners, the government realized that this new policy was undermining the social political order of autocracy. Therefore, the imperial government tried to maintain the estate order and the hierarchy of ethnic groups by estates based on the cooperation with their elites. Despite many political actions against some of the non-Russian elites, most of these elites were able to preserve their dominant social status in their respective regions. Thirdly, the cultural hierarchy. The hierarchy of ethnic groups by estates, since the 18th century, was challenged and then partially eclipsed by cultural factors. The first of these factors was religion, which had always been an official criterion of demarcation, but which had remained subordinate to the estate principle. In the first half of the 18th century, for a short time, non-Christians were segregated from Christians as inovierci. In this period, the Muslim Tatar nobility was deprived of noble rank and transformed into state peasants. The enlightened absolutism of Catherine II caused the importance of religions to recede and the evolutionist principle of the way of life to come to the fore, demarcating above all the so-called progressive settled people from the so-called backward nomads, the Inorodzi. With the rise of the concept of the modern nation, namely the secular political community of will and the ethnic cultural community that transcended ethnic boundaries, Russian ethno-national elements gradually emerged as politically significant in the course of the 19th century. They mingled with the dynastic, estate, civilizatory, and religious principles without completely prevailing over the traditional factors of integration and demarcation in Tsarist policy. The new nationalism exerted less influence over government policy than over Russian society, parts of which were increasingly under the sway of nationalism. These nationalists began to demand that ethnic Russians of all classes should be privileged vis-à-vis the non-Russians. The cultural hierarchy of the ethnic groups of the Tsarist Empire was determined by the degree of otherness, with the variable categories of way of life, religion, and language. In the 19th century, it can be represented as a system of concentric circles extending from the innermost circle of Russians outwards to the even more alien. The entire system of subjects of the empire was defined externally by opposition to foreigners, inostrannie, potannie. The subjects of the Tsar were legally divided, first of all, into the two groups of natural inhabitants, prirodnie obyvateli, and aliens, allogens, inorodzi. Since the Spiransky reform of 1822, the inorodzi included the unsettled population of the empire, such as the nomadic Kalmyks, Kazakhs, the Buryats, and other ethnic groups of Siberia. The criterion of definition of this legal term was way of life. The nomadic inorodzi were not equal subjects of the empire. They had restricted rights, but on the other hand, fewer obligations. This principle was violated later by the inclusion of the Jews, which were by no means nomads, into the legal category of inorodzy. But unlike the nomadic inorodzy, the Jews simultaneously were integrated into the estate system and were required to render contributions and services such as providing recruits. If not in principle, then in practice, the settled Muslims of Turkestan were also declared to be inorodzy. Their status as Tuzimtsi, indigents, was largely equivalent to that of the nomads of Central Asia. Therefore, in the second half of the 19th century, the view of the nomadic way of life as backward was no longer alone a necessary criterion for allocation to the inorodzy. In essence, the decisive criterion became that of foreign race. The inorodzy, who formed the outermost circle of the cultural hierarchy of the Tsarist Empire, were those ethnic groups whose cultural and racial characteristics were deemed to make them impossible to integrate into the empire. They were therefore isolated from the natural inhabitants and discriminated against. On the other hand, they were exposed to only slight pressure to integrate. Moving inwards, the next circle was defined by the Christian-non-Christian opposition. The religious criterion had long played a certain role in the hierarchy of the ethnic groups. In the first half of the 18th century, forced conversions to Christianity were performed. But since the time of Catherine II, the non-Christians of the empire, with the exception of the Jews, remained unmolested for most of the time. The practice of non-Christian faith was guaranteed. Only missionary activity was forbidden the non-Orthodox. Through the creation of official institutions, the state sought to keep control on those of other faiths. While the remnants of animists in Siberia, as well as the Lamaists and Jews, belonged to the outer circle of inorodzy, the second circle of settled non-Christians consisted of several Muslim groups, the Volga Tatars, Bashkirs, Crimean Tatars, and the Muslims of the Caucasus region. Most of these ethnic groups had elites that had been partially co-opted into the nobility of the Tsarist Empire. Even in the second half of the 19th century, the Tsarist state scarcely made any effort to convert Muslims to Christianity or to Russify them linguistically. In the next circle inwards came the non-Orthodox Christians. Westernized official Russia guaranteed the practice of other Christian faiths and recognized their church organizations. Only the ban on missionary activity applied to them as well. The Orthodox Church did not try to conduct systematic missionary activity among non-Orthodox Christians. This was the case primarily for the ethnic groups with indigenous rural or urban elites, namely the Gregorian Armenians, the Catholic Poles, the Lutheran Finlanders, and German Baths. The Uniate Belarusians and Ukrainians were not recognized as Catholics at all, but were regarded as apostates from Orthodoxy. Their church organization was therefore dissolved and their faithful persecuted. From the 1860s, the Tsarist government imposed successive restrictions against the churches and clergies of several non-Orthodox Christian groups, and then switched partly to a policy of linguistic assimilation. This occurred first of all with the Poles, and with them the Lithuanians, and was a reaction to the January uprising of 1863. Only at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20s were restrictive measures taken against the Lutheran Church and the German language in the Baltic provinces and against the Armenian Church and its schools. These measures to impose orthodoxy and Russification were not motivated by cultural religious considerations alone, but also by the criterion of political loyalty. Belief in the inadequate loyalty of several non-Russian groups, which were generally also suspected of subversive contact with foreign powers, combined with the growing nationalist demarcation from all foreign elements. The three innermost circles encompassed the Orthodox ethnic groups of the empire. Their confession bound them more closely than the other groups to ruler, dynasty, and empire. The Orthodox Church was regarded as the leading and ruling church in the empire. It alone had the right to conduct missionary activity, while apostasy from Orthodox belief up to 1905 was strictly prohibited under threat of criminal persecution. The outer circle of the Orthodox contained Orthodox non-Slavs, namely the Georgians, after the abolition of their autocephalous church, the Romanians of Bessarabia, Moldavians, and the Christianized animists of the Volga-Ural region. Orthodoxy and Russianness were often equated in Russia, and in the 19th century, the Orthodox ethnic groups were exposed to a stronger pressure to Russify than were the non-Orthodox of the empire. Before the mid-19th century, Russian schools were already established for Orthodox non-Slavs like the Georgians and Moldavians. And in the final third of the century, the policy of linguistic Russification was intensified vis-à-vis both of these groups. In the case of the Christianized animists, however, native language schools were encouraged at the same time in order to strengthen them in their faith first. The policy of assimilation had no long-lasting successes with the Georgians, while the Romanian elite of Bessarabia was partially Russified. The circles of the Orthodox Eastern Slavs occupied the center of the system of concentric rings. Officially, the Russian people, Ruski Narod, included all Eastern Slavs, while the Great Russians, Little Russians, and White Russians were conceded only the status of tribes. Ukrainian and Belarusian were regarded as dialects, narichia, not as language, yazyk, like Russian. The demarcation of Russians and Ukrainians became a problem with the establishment of the Ukrainian national movement and with the continuing formation of a Russian nation and the emergence of modern Russian nationalism in the second half of the 19th century. If the Russian nation included all Eastern Slavs, then the nation building and national movement of the Ukrainians directly threatened the unity of the Russian nation. This is one cause of the particularly intense persecution of the cultural activities of the Ukrainians. Despite the repressive language policy, the Ukrainians did not become a center of attention of Tsarist policy until the beginning of the 20th century. In the view of the government, the loyal Little Russians, or harmless Chachli, were dangerous only in connection with the Poles or with Austria. While the Ukrainians and Belarusians were subjected to harsh repression as ethnic groups, as individuals, they were discriminated against less than the ethnic groups of the outer circles. Since Ukrainians and Belarusians were regarded as Russians, all careers were in principle open to them on the condition that they used the Russian language. As Orthodox Eastern Slavs, the Ukrainians and Belarusians were neither isolated nor disadvantaged on the basis of confessional or racial criteria. The dividing line between the innermost circle of Great Russians and the second circle of the other Orthodox Eastern Slavs was therefore blurred in the 19th century. As for the ethnic Russians, their language and culture were in the very center of the circles. In pre-national times, they were challenged by other languages and cultures, such as the Polish, German, or French. The factor of language and culture only in the second half of the 19th century became political. Only in this time it was systematically privileged vis-à-vis other elite languages and cultures. In conclusion, the system of cultural circles had a dual effect. The further the ethnic group was from the Orthodox Russian center, the greater was the legal, social, and political discrimination against its members. But the smaller was the danger to its ethnic essence as a community. The assimilating effect of the Russian language and culture was weakest among the Inarotsi and the other non-Christian groups. It was somewhat stronger among the non-Orthodox Christians, stronger still among Orthodox non-Slavs like Karelians, Mordenians, and Moldavians, and strongest among the Orthodox Eastern Slavs. This applies both to the Russification policy promoted by the government and to the natural assimilation of those who migrated to Russian areas or Russian-dominated towns. Finally, some general conclusions. After the emancipation of the peasants and with the modernization of the empire, the estate categories and therefore the ethnic hierarchy by estate gradually lost their importance. The new force of nationalism, which demanded loyalty to the nation, challenged the social order by estates and tried to integrate ethnic groups vertically. Russian and non-Russian nationalism undermined the socio-political order of the Tsarist Empire based on loyalty to the dynasty and on the horizontal estate system. In this view, it was no more belonging to an estate that was the decisive criterion defining people, but ethnic affiliation. Loyalty was now owed primarily to the nation, no longer to the dynasty and ruler. Around 1900, the criteria of political loyalty and culture were converging. Based on the model of some European national states like Hungary or Germany, the view had now gained ground in Russia that allegiance to the state would have to be congruent with allegiance to the ethnic nation. Nationalists now regarded non-Orthodox and non-Russians a priori as unreliable. While political loyalty had earlier been judged by whether groups had taken part in insurrections or conspiracies, ethno-national affiliation now became a mark of loyalty or disloyalty. Russian nationalists use now the term Inorodtsy, here no longer as a legal but as a socio-political term or ideological term, to isolate all non-Russians or non-Orthodox from the natural inhabitants of the empire and claimed Russia exclusively for ethnic Russians, Russia для русских. The government supported these nationalist currents, which were reinforced by foreign policy tensions, in order to stabilize its rule. It did not do so consistently, however, and achieved its aims only in part and only at the cost of further alienation of large parts of the non-Russian population. So I would like to stress that the hierarchies of political loyalty and of estate were defining structural elements of the Tsarist Empire and that they remained effective until its end. They were supplemented, but only partially eclipsed by the national cultural hierarchy of ethnic groups. The three hierarchies of ethnic groups described here schematically continued to exert their influence beyond the Russian Revolution. It is true that social hierarchies in the Soviet Union were turned upside down and that the categories of estate and nobility disappeared. The principle of cooptation of non-Russian elites, however, remained in force, as did the premises of political loyalty. For the new social hierarchy of Soviet nationalities, the respective strengths of the industrial proletariat and of the Communist Party were the decisive elements. So, the traditional peasant peoples remained at the bottom and the Russians at the top of the hierarchy, while some of the mobilized diaspora groups, as the Jews and the Armenians, were raised up. The system of cultural circles was also altered. In the 1920s, the discrimination of non-Russians substantially decreased. In this way, the secularized and linguistically largely Russified Jews were permitted to break out of their segregation. The distance of the center from the nationalities in Asia, however, was maintained. Under Stalin, the Russians regained their privileged position in the cultural hierarchy, which had been placed in question in the 1920s. The condition of political loyalty again became crucially important. Together with other elements of the Tsarist ideology, the Stalinist hierarchy of nationalities assumed many rankings from pre-revolutionary times. So, the brutal sedentarization of the Kazakhs was directed against the traditionally unreliable nomads too. And in my opinion, it is not by accident that during the Second World War, the Germans, the Crimean Tatars, the Kalmyks, the Chechens, and other Caucasian mountaineers were forcefully deported to Asia. That is exactly the same ethnic groups who already in Tsarist Russia had the reputation of being unreliable traitors and partially had been forced to emigration or deportation under the Tsars. The rough model of hierarchies of ethnic groups could be applied to other polyethnic empires like the Ottoman, the Habsburg, or even the British or the Chinese Empire, elaborating further the comparative reflections of Dominic Leven in one of his recent articles and maybe in a forthcoming book. The interaction of the three constantly changing hierarchies shows that the complex structures of the polyethnic empire and the far from uniform government policy cannot be conveyed by one-dimensional concepts. So the Tsarist Empire was not merely a prison house of peoples, as Lenin and non-Russian national historians have asserted. The term Russification does not adequately describe the uneven and complex nationalities policy of the Tsarist and of the Soviet Empire. The Russian and the Soviet empires were not classic colonial empires, as is often maintained. Most Asiatic regions of the empire were indisputably colonies. The ethnic groups living there were territorially, socially, culturally, and racially distant from the imperial center. They were on the lower ranks of the estate and cultural hierarchy too. On the other hand, the regions in the northwest of the empire were indeed peripheries dependent on the center, but they were considerably more developed economically and culturally than the co-rich regions of Russia. They, in my opinion, can therefore not be called colonies. The term internal colony, used by Lenin, Soviet economists in the 20s, and modern social scientists, in my view, also does not adequately describe this relationship. An important difference from the colonial empires of the West was the absence of a bifurcation into an imperial ethnic Russian stratum of rulers and non-Russian lower strata. It is true that the majority of the political and military elite of the empire was Russian or Russified, but the Russians as a people were not systematically favored or privileged. Around 1900, the Russians were still average among the nationalities of the empire in terms of urbanization and level of education, and even lower in life expectancy. The Russians never were a typical imperial ruling people. Is, after the implosion of the Soviet Union, the age of empires over forever? It seems to me that some of their characteristics remain important for an understanding of the actual situation. So, the model of the three hierarchies and the stereotypes connected with them perhaps can be useful for the interpretation of the policy of Russia towards her national minorities such as the Chechens and the Tatars and the so-called near abroad, as well as the reaction of non-Russians to this policy. The new all-Russian state, which did not take the ethnic designation Ruski, but maintained the traditional imperial name Rasiski, is partially following the footsteps of the former empires. For ethnic Russians, this means that even today they have to carry the burden of their imperial past. On the one hand, with the pretension of being the ruling people, proud of the universal presence of a great power. On the other hand, with the growing understanding that the empire severely hampered their social, economic, political, and cultural development. The Russian nation can be characterized as a belated nation, even in the East European context. The question is open whether Russia will cease to be an empire and become a national state, and it is not clear today what kind of nation the Russians, who are both Ruskie and Rossiyane, will prefer. Thank you for your patience.
Well, Professor Kapela very kindly said he would answer some questions. We have 5 or 10 minutes. Since I have the pleasure of having dinner with him tonight and tomorrow, I will forego first bite. But if anyone does want to ask, the floor's open to you.
You described the Jews as a diaspora group, but initially a lot of those people in the Russian Empire who professed Judaism were indigenous. I refer, of course, to the Khazars. Were they completely eliminated before the start of the 19th century, or did they have their own hierarchy, and were they part of the system?
Now, this is one of the most difficult and disputed question of Eastern European history, and I only name the only can mention the name of Köstler, who wrote about this. But to shorten this, I would say that in modern scholarship there is no continuity, or nearly no continuity, from Khazar Jewish people to Ashkenazi Jewish people, who made up the overwhelming majority of the population, the Poland-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and which then in the end of 18th century became subjects of the Russian Tsar. Therefore, I would say, of course, if you want to mention the term diaspora, if they were Khazars, they were diaspora groups in Eastern Europe too, because the Khazars had their center on the lower Volga, and there were no Jews, no more Jews in the late Middle Ages.
When do the imperial rulers begin to feel, or begin to see nationalism, including Russian nationalism, as a threat to their power?
In the sources, I think it's difficult to see, because there are, as I tried to explain, other categories who were overwhelming for them. But in principle, I would say nationalism from the beginning was seen as dangerous for the empire. For instance, the revolution of 1848 was seen, as we know, by Nicholas the First as a big danger for the Russian state, and this was the national revolution in Central Europe. Therefore, I think in principle they realized that, but after that, in the second half of the 19th century, I think, and therefore I mentioned the example of Germany and Hungary, for instance, they realized that it could be, nationalism could be used too as an integrating force for a socially destabilizing state. And they tried to use it as instrument, but as I think, in the whole, without a success.
What impact, if any, do you feel the great debate between the Slavophiles and the Westernizers within the Russian intelligentsia during the course of the 19th century have on the shaping of the ethnic policies of the Tsarist state?
I feel that their influence was restricted because both groups, if they existed, but both ways of thinking, maybe, were oppositional to, in principle, oppositional to the autocracy. to the Tsarist Empire, and therefore they were perceived as opposition movements. Later on, of course, the former Slavophiles intermingled with Pan-Slavism and so on, and then, of course, an influence on Tsarist policy was obvious. But in the beginning, I would say not, but of course, these men in the second half of the 19th century, the former Slavophiles, had influence of this policy of integration by means of nationalism.
Well, our reception begins at 1:30. And oh, is there someone? Sorry, yes.
A bit louder, please. I
traditional belief among the Russians that a specific ethnic group is a sort of hereditary enemy or a hereditary friend of the Orthodox. Mm-hmm. You know, Russian. Mm-hmm.
Of course, I agree with all additional differentiations, and I agree that this model is very, very rough, very, very general. But on the other hand, I think for me the most important question was: did the Russian state perceive an upper stratum of an ethnic group as an elite comparable to the Russian nobility? And of course that was the most important criterion, and this was done, I believe, in the beginning and maybe after, not only in, or maybe more in legal terms than in economic, as you mentioned. But of course the social status played a role, but this legal thinking, in my opinion, was very important. If someone was a noble, he had to be recognized as a noble, even when he was a poor peasant in reality. What concerns this question of older stereotypes, images of ethnic groups, of course, they existed, and I mentioned, for instance, the image of the nomad. Of course, it's an old one in Russian folk belief, unreliable nomads and reliable settlers, and so on. That plays of course a role, and I think that it's important for this policy too. And I won't deny that we have to recognize, of course, this tradition.
No, you first.
My question is a very technical question. You used several times the phrase Polish intrigue.
Polish intrigue.
Ah, yes.
This is taken from the sources. Yes, intriga, Polish, Polish. How to translate into English? Intrigue.
No, intrigue is
intrigue
fine.
Intrigue is fine. Yes. No, that this is part of this image of certain ethnic groups, which are traitors. This is, I think, very important for political thinking in Tsarist Russia, because loyalty was so crucially important. If some groups were perceived as disloyal, this was very, very important. And this it's often in the press, in the nationalist press, this Polish intrigue is coming a stereotype for Poles, and I know it very well from Ukrainian history, and there's written all these Malorussian Ukrainophiles are very, very simple people, but behind it is Polish intrigue. And the Poles, as a people with an elite and with a state tradition, they are taken seriously, unless all the other. It's only one expression of this stereotypes of this law.
One more question. You had something you wanted to do.
Oh, yes. As you would probably agree with me, notions of hierarchy based on, or ranking based on such grounds as culture, ethnicity, race, and so on, are central to a lot of racist thinking during the 19th century and indeed beyond the 19th century. But how helpful, or indeed how much of a hindrance, do you think the term, the concept of racism might be in describing some of the thinking and some of the actual manifestations of Tsarist policy towards its own ethnic minorities?
That's a very interesting and very, very difficult question. It's no research on these questions, because Russians always maintained that they didn't have this notion of race. Because they were living together with their Asian peoples for a long time, and they had the experience. And I agree with that in comparison with Western colonial empires, the element of race is weak. This remark was reappearing, but in Tsarist Russia. But I expressed it in my lecture. The question of Inorodzhi told me that the only explanations to put Jews and nomads and Muslim sedentary people into one legal category is racist. It's no other possibility. And of course, in the case of Jews, then not only religion but race play a role. And therefore, I think this problem has to be researched in the future more seriously as it was done until now.
Good. Thank you very much indeed, both for the talk and the questions. Just a word, we're having a reception on the fifth floor of the senior common room. I think we can squeeze virtually everyone in. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.